whichever channel you're listening to. It's the battle for the hearts and minds, selling grown-ups nursery rhymes. And we fall for it every time, 'cause we're consumers of marketing. Marketing, marketing is everything, yeah. Division is a bad idea. You must believe everything that you hear. Remember when we used to laugh before they sold us in half? We need the laugh for decency. We need the right for the money and marketing. Marketing, marketing is everything, yeah. We know what people want. We know what people want. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. And I am not 11. We know what people want. We know what people want. I said, no, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. You make me wanna throw up. Stick it out like a sore thumb. And now I doubt supervision. A karaoke one-man band. How to give that man a hand? 'Cause he's working on his noble plan. And we're all living in Wonderland. Wonderland, Wonderland. Give that man a Clio. We know what people want. We know what people want. Now you don't. Now you don't. Now you don't. You're just giving us the finger. We know what people want. We know what people want. Now you don't. Now you don't. Now you don't. 'Cause we ain't on your medical. Watching ads for Ask Your Doctor. In between a fear and hate, we're gonna sell, sell, celebrate. And Madison Avenue is raking in the money. And marketing, marketing, marketing is everything, yeah. We know what people want.
Hello and welcome again to the Strange Brew podcast. My name is Jason Barnard and that was People by Ian Hunter from his new album Defiance Part 2. And that is because, of course, I've got the great Ian Hunter on the Strange Brew today to talk about his solo work, new material and diving back into Mott the Hoople. So let's hear my chat with Ian. Hi Ian, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I got you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Yep.
I have to say, listening to Defiance Part 2, I was so impressed, especially the opener, People. It's got that anthemic feel, but as I've heard, it's got a bit more of a political element or a commentary on society. Is that something that marks it out differently to the first part of Defiance?
Yeah. First one was kind of COVID had set in and people weren't that happy. So I tried to avoid those kind of subjects as much as I could. However, it caught up with me. This is a bit more politically scientific.
And as well with the backing, certainly in relation to that song in particular, People, it's got a bit of a harder edge at time. I think that's got some of Cheap Trick on it, hasn't it?
People, yeah. That's Cheap Trick, right? Three of them on there, yeah.
Precious, which is the lead single. So you've got Joe Elliott and Brian May on that.
Yeah, and Tyler Hawkins, yeah.
Yourself and Brian May go back into the 70s because Queen supported Mott back in the day, didn't they?
Yeah, that was the only band they ever supported. They pretty much shot up from there, you know. They opened for us in England and then they opened for us in the States. And then Brian got hepatitis, actually, so they had to cancel halfway through the American tour. And the next thing we knew, they were headliners. And they were great people. I mean, it couldn't happen to nicer people. And Brian, I said in this track, I said, you know, fancy putting a bit of guitar on it. And back it comes, you know, with all these guitar tracks on it and the bass as well.
And that combination of Brian and Joe Elliott and yourself, I've seen some great footage of all three of you about 20 years back doing all the way from Memphis. You've all played together before.
Oh, yeah. You know, if ever I'm in London, Joe's always around, you know, and Brian sometimes, you know, in Shepherd's Bush or something like that. Yeah. Remember the Astoria?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great gig. I remember Brian got up on that one and Joe. Yeah. That band were a great band to tour with, Queen. I mean, you get bored when you're on tours with your own band. And those guys were like, it was like we were all as one. It was lovely. And Fred was outrageous, you know, which made your day, you know. And we had Ariel Bender on our thing, you know, and he takes everything up 20%. It was a lot of fun. And one of the main reasons I always wanted to be in rock and roll was camaraderie, you know, the fun of it.
Brian said you were mentors in a way because they watched Mott live and that helped them as a stepping stone when they headlined.
Yeah, they'd be standing outside the stage, checking it out. Because they hadn't really figured out what they were going to do as a stage show. You know, they figured out they're pretty happening with their music and everything, but they were just watching to see how one conducted oneself. I kind of learned off Jerry Lee Lewis. There's a difference between, you know, trying to please people and running the show. And I think that's what Fred was looking for. And slightly, there's a bit of arrogance involved, you know. It goes down well. At least it did in those days.
And how did you pull together the guys that you collaborated with on Part 1 and Part 2 of Defiance? Did you know them all or were they friends of friends?
I knew a few of them from odd meetings, just like an odd bump into kind of situation. I don't know any of them properly, you know. I knew Waddy I'd met before, the guys from Tom Petty I'd met before, way back, you know, somewhere down the road. But I hadn't met a lot of them. I mean, I had Billy Gibbons I'd met. I'd never met Slash. I'd met Taylor briefly. You know, there's a guy called Ross Halfen who was a photographer.
Yeah.
He would ring me and say, you know, Slash, or somebody would, you know, they're up for it if you want to do it. Because they had the home studios and COVID was on, you know, nobody was out. So they had time on their hands and they weren't doing anything. And so that's how the idea was formed. It wasn't formed by me. It was formed by Ross Halfen with a little help of Mike Kobayashi, who runs my business end of things.
And how did you split the material between Part 1 and Part 2?
Part 1 came together pretty quick. That naturally solved it. You know, I had more difficulty with this one. This one's denser and it's more even. Part 1, it kind of told you where a specific track would tell you where it wanted to go, you know, like it helped. But this one was difficult. I'm still not sure it's in the right sequence. I look in the mirror, what do I see? Hey, no magna cum laude, staring back at me. Qualifications, leave a lot to be desired.
standard required.
And there's a number of songs there that comment on the world that's going on. For example, Fiction. Is that about misinformation that's going around?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's always awkward in interviews because they ask you to explain what you've already explained. But yeah, it is more. You really don't want to make it worse than it already is because the press do that anyway. But this is what you see, you know. It's just my interpretation of it.
And a few of the songs also seem to refer to that divide between people, which seems to be increasing over time, where people are talking to each other but separately in their own bubble and then throwing things across.
Yeah. I think we're going the wrong way, you know. I think AI, the internet, all this stuff is causing more trouble than it's worth. There's good points and there's bad points, but, you know, everybody's got an opinion now. Some people shouldn't have one. Probably I'm one of them. I don't know.
And there's also What Would I Do Without You, which has got Lucinda Williams. How did that duet come together?
She came to a gig in Nashville and we got on, you know, and her husband's a really nice guy and he's a bit of a fan of mine. And so we asked her, you know, if she'd be interested. And it's great because a lot of these, you know, with Lucinda and with the Robinson Brothers, they'll sing the full thing a couple of times, you know, and then they'll just say, you know, if you don't want bits of it, don't use it. You know, they're very nice that way. It's not like you have to have me on all through the song and all that kind of stuff. It's not like that. It's much too, you know, they're like, take what you want, leave what you want. It's fine. And Lucinda was like that. So just use what you want.
And you mentioned the sequencing of Defiance Part 2, but you do end up with the song Hope. So it does finish on a positive note.
That was a no-brainer. That was always going to be the last track.
There's a song on Defiance Part 1, which is called I Hate Hate, which seems to be from a similar lineage, but trying to push a more positive agenda.
Yeah, I like that lyric a lot because it's simple and it's direct. I really, from a lyricist's point of view, you know, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for simplicity and directness. Lennon was a master at it, you know.
And there's also the song on that album, This Is What I'm Here For. So was that about you digging back towards your early years?
Yeah, Waddy did a great job on it. I thought that was definitely a last track, you know, because that is what I'm here for. When I was like 16, 17, 18, you know, when Fats Domino first started and Elvis, I think they started in 54. And then soon to be followed by Chuck Berry and all the greats, you know, Jerry Lee, Sam Cooke, all the people, Buddy Holly. That's when they get you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like we got Joe Elliott when he was 15, you know. That seems to be the age where you kind of get stuck for life with something, you know. You know, that sort of paves the path to some people, musicians, something they hear, and, you know, that's it. Off you go.
There's also Bed of Roses from that album, and that echoes your time playing at the Star Club, doesn't it?
Yeah. I was there mid to late 60s. I think it closed 69. Ringo was there earlier on. They were there before. But yeah, it was a fantastic club. It was a fantastic time. Sheridan was still there, Tony Sheridan.
Yeah.
I was his gopher. Go and get this, go and get that. A very authoritative guy. Yeah, but, you know, he was the original singer with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Roy Young also had been asked to join the Beatles. He was there. He was at the Star Club when I was there. And Roy was the king of Hamburg, you know.
Yeah.
And turned the Beatles down because the Star Club offered him a Cadillac to stay. And he would play with anybody, you know, organ, piano, sing. He would play with anybody, but... they'd asked him to join the Beatles, and he turned them down to stay in Hamburg with his Cadillac. And I asked him in later years, how did that feel? And he said, oh, you know, I get up every morning, I bang my face against the wall once, and I'm fine.
It's well known that Hamburg knocked the Beatles into shape. Did it have that sort of effect with you in terms of playing so much in a short period?
Yeah, you know, it was great. I was a bass player. I was playing with a guy called Freddie Fingers Lee. You played every night, you know, like in England, you played St. Mary's Village Hall on a Saturday night, and that was about it. You might play a working man's club on a Monday, £8. But in Germany, you know, you played 7 nights a week. Sometimes, I mean, I played 13 hours, one in the afternoon till 2 in the morning. That only happened once.
Right.
But the drummer couldn't get off his kit. His ass was cemented to the seat, you know. 50 minutes, you 10 minutes off. 50 minutes, 10 minutes off. So you learned.
was born, a fallout shelter from the storm. And I was proud to be a fall in the bed of roses. You can never go back, so they say.
And in the 60s as well, you were writing songs, weren't you?
I was writing them, and Freddie Fingers Lee said to me, don't ever sing them. You're writing decent songs, but don't ever sing them. But, you know, nature took its course.
How did you end up in Mott then? Because you were in the Shriekers, you'd written some songs. That connection, how was it made?
There's a guy called Miller Anderson, who later on became a pretty well-known blues player in Europe and England, and he was living in the next street to me. We used to go to auditions together. We were working in factories. I got a phone call from a guy called Bill Farley at Regent Sound. Regent Sound was kind of like Sun Records, little four-track in London. And we'd gone down there and we'd done sessions for various people who'd go in there, and they weren't very good. It was like, you got £5 for a session, you know. He would sometimes have bands in there auditioning for new members. And Bill rang me one night and said, you know, this band's down here and I think you might fit with them. And they tried everybody else, and because I lived in the Archway, it was a bit of a schlep to the West End, Denmark Street. But the buses were, I was there in about 30 minutes, which was amazing. They weren't overly impressed, but it was like, he'll do till something better comes along, you know.
How did you pull together the material for those first few albums? Because there seemed to be quite a few covers, and then Mick and Pete were writing some songs.
Well, Pete and Mick were supposed to be the writers. They didn't hire me as a, you know, they hired me as a piano player, you know. But then Guy liked me as a singer because he said I sounded like Dylan, you know, which I did. Not being a proper singer, I sort of figured out, you know, like people like Dylan were getting it over their way, you know, getting it over in their own way. And so that was the course I decided. And I used Dylan as a stepping stone, if you like, for the first couple of years. And everybody moaned at me, so I had to stop. And by that time, you know, you start finding your own thing, you know, the way you can get yourself across. And the band weren't too convinced at first. And then by the time the band didn't want me in the band, then Guy wanted me in the band. It was very, very delicate the first 9 months. Meanwhile, we're making these records. We don't know what we're doing. Guy's like, do this, do that, you know. It was pretty frantic. And then we started touring, and the touring got kind of popular. We were selling everywhere in the end, you know, like the Newcastle City Halls, of the, you know, like the Birmingham, you know, the City Halls. But we never had, we didn't have any record success, and you'd have to have that to sustain. People aren't going to continue to turn up if you don't chart, at least in those days. And that's where David came into the scene, yeah.
There were some great songs on those Island albums, like Waterloo and Rock and Roll Queen. Do you think it was just that the material, you were still trying to still find your own voice and feeling things out?
Yeah, yeah. We were in the learning process. I mean, Mick Rouse was a Steve Stills fan. He was West Coasty, you know. So we were kind of like, I'm at the Little Richard side of things, and he's at the West Coast side of things. We're trying to figure all that out, you know, and the band were trying to figure it out with us. I mean, we like the slower stuff. We like the water lows. We liked all that stuff on Wildlife. But then the stage show was crazy. You know, it wasn't adding up. It wasn't making much sense. It needed something to meet in the middle. And it did to a degree on the last my album before Bowie, and that was when Guy Stevens producing that. That was pretty much Mott because it was frantic.
It was like Brain Capers.
Yeah, it was a pretty crazy album, and all kinds of things were going down. But we let loose on that, and that was somewhat near to what they were live. But we still didn't, you know, and Guy didn't. We'd just go in there and tear a place up, you know. I mean, we didn't have any idea of what was going on behind the controls. Glyn Johns was the engineer. We just went in and Guy screamed and shouted and you're better than anybody and all this kind of stuff. And we'd have to wait for about an hour while he went through these whole diatribes. And then he'd unleash you and off we went.
You mentioned David coming on the scene. So how did he hear that you guys were on the verge of splitting up?
We had split. We split up in Switzerland. We came back and Pete now was looking for a bass job. So he asked, he found out that David was looking for a bass player. And then David apparently had already got one or he didn't want Mott to split up anyway. He said, you can't do that. So Pete rang me and said, look, this bloke wants us to go down and listen to this record. I think he sent us one first that we didn't particularly like, and then the second one was Dudes. And he played us that in Regent Street, sitting on the floor in an office, in De Vries's office. And that was it, all Young Dudes.
Your version in Mott is, to my mind, far superior than the version that got released later by David. What was it that truly made it a great single and superior to David's version? Was it arranged differently?
Well, I think he'd done it already. You know, the story goes that he hadn't done it. He gave it us. He just wrote it overnight and gave it us. And that's not true. He'd already done it. He did it in the key of C, which is a lower key. We took it up to D, made it a little more, you know, powerful. He hadn't done the rap, which I did over the hooks to make the hooks a little more interesting. He hadn't got that amazing Mick Ralphs intro. He hadn't got Fally, who was great on the organ, you know.
Yeah.
But he had the knowledge of what he'd done and what he didn't want to do again. And it all came together. A couple of nights, we did that and one of the boys, Olympic Barnes. And quite magical. Quick, great song. Great, great song.
Don't want to stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping up the stars from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, same with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got Stones, we never got it off on that revolution stuff. What a drag! Too many snacks. Nah, I drunk a lot of wine and I'm feeling fine. Gotta raise some cap to bed. Oh, is there concrete all around, or is it in my
After All the Young Dudes, you released a string of singles that matched the greatness of All the Young Dudes. Was it almost a challenge that you didn't have to be reliant on David's songs?
The press. They could be pretty, you know. Now it was going to be we were David's band, you know. He offered us, I forget what the next, I know there was Suffragette City was in it at one point, either before or after. But we only ever did Dudes because it was like, you know, we want to be Mott the Hoople. So then Mick and I spent a frantic 9 months trying to find a single to follow the single because this is what you do, you know. And finally I came up with a song called Honolulu Boogie, and that I think it got to about 11, something like that. So it was okay, you know what I mean? And then we had Memphis, Roll Away the Stone, Golden Age, and they were all our songs. So, but we still lost people because they'd like the original crazy version of Mott. Now we were more sophisticated, apparently.
Do you think the experience of recording all the young dudes shifted the sound of Mott? Did you respond to what was going on around you, whether it was David or other bands like T-Rex?
Well, you know, we had no experience with Guy. That wasn't, that was just a gang fight in a studio, you know. We didn't know you could use, we didn't know what you could do behind a board. We didn't understand how you could enhance things. And there was a guy called Bill Price. We went to Air Studios when we did the Mott album, which was the one after All the Young Dudes. And we happened to bump into Bill Price, who's an amazing engineer. And we started losing, you know, using that, actually using the studio instead of sort of waltzing in there and just jamming.
From now on.
Copper Hoople seem to have a great connection with your fans, working class kids.
Well, I've been in factories for years, you know. I wasn't young when I was 29 when I joined Mott, and I've been in factories, and not much fun, but, you know, lyrically great. You know, I had fodder. It's not like I came straight out of school. You know, what are you going to sing about? Your girlfriend, you know, well, that's only one track. I'd been around, I'd had like 40 jobs. And with the jobs came the lyrics.
When you had a song that you wrote, like Roll Away the Stone, how did it work in terms of arranging that with the group, given that some of the songs were quite ornate and had backing singers, etc.?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really have that much to do with that end of things. You know, Mick Ralphs was brilliant. We all dug in there, you know, but I would say Mick Ralphs would, and Bill Price, the engineer. And then we'd all pile in. Faders went one way only. Bill would get extremely angry with us. Pete always wanted the bass to be the loudest instrument. All the mistakes you make. But I remember Roxy were in Air 1. We were in Air 2. And Brian and Eno came down to our studio. And I don't know what we were doing. We were doing something. And we were still looking for a producer.
Right.
And they were like, why? You know, this sounds great. And so we thought, it never actually occurred to us not to have a producer, you know, until that point. But what was going on sounded good, and Bill Price was great, and we just figured leave it at that, you know. I guess, you know, Brian Ferry and Eno did us a favour there.
What led to Mick Ronson joining the group?
Well, we were pretty exhausted. He'd left, Bowie had split, right? So Mick was on his own. Mick was living in a flat behind the Albert Hall. And I heard he was around, you know, we'd done a couple of years with Luther, and Luther had been fantastic live, you know, but we hadn't really got much out of him in the studio. Mick Rock, the photographer, said, you know, why don't you go and see Ronno, you know? So I popped around to Ronno's, and it was all over in one night. De Vries was in America, so he was talking to De Vries, because at that time, Mick was still in his solo career. Meanwhile, he's left me in a room while he's on the phone, and there's a little drum machine in that room. It wasn't even a drum machine. It was before drums. It was one of those things that waltz, quick step.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, and I was fiddling with this thing. I was fiddling, and I got this groove. Well, actually, what I did was I pushed every button down. There was about 7 buttons. I pushed them all down, and out came this rhythm. And I started writing Once Bitten, Twice Shy while I'm waiting for him to get off the phone with Tony De Vries. At 5 a.m., I'm pretty much, this is going well with Once Bitten. And he comes in, he goes, yeah, I'm going to join, you know. So he was in. He was in not for very long, because he didn't get on with the other guys in the band. But we did stuff like Saturday gigs, which he more or less, you know, arranged, produced. And it's a shame, you know, because it was great what he was doing, but it was short-lived.
You didn't know.
what was it like working with Roy Thomas Baker?
Oh, Roy's lovely. I mean, great sense of humour. I think great contribution with Queen was his sense of humour, you know, because they were so intense when they would do stuff. He's an extremely funny guy. And like David, he mixed thin because in those days, transistor radios were the thing, you know. That's how everybody listened. And then sounded better through transistor radios.
There's a song where Mick contributes vocals, When the Daylight Comes, from your album You're Never Alone with a Schizophrenic. How did you encourage him to sing? Because he was quite shy at times, wasn't he?
He used to tell me off. He used to tell me what to do. I mean, there was two Micks, you know. Well, there was a few Micks, but the Mick in the studio was bossy. And we were in the power station, and I was talking to Meatloaf and Bruce.
Yeah.
And he came out and he goes, "You can do this vocal in a minute. You know, because if you don't do this vocal, I'm doing it." I said, "Well, do it." So he did. And it sounded great, you know, so it was fine.
Sweet woman, what's your name? You spell it.
How did you pull together the material that you did with Mick for Ellen Foley? Because there's songs on there like Don't Let Go that are amongst some of your best.
That must have been on a roll. I mean, we had the Schizophrenic. Everything was going really well at the time. We had great management. We had a guy called Steve Popovich, and it would chart in big over here, you know. We were just in a good frame of mind, and Steve Popovich also had Ellen Foley, you know, who'd been and she'd been doing the touring with Meatloaf, and amazing voice, incredible voice. Mm. Would I do Foley, you know? And then I'm thinking, because Mick was hard up as usual,
yeah.
So I'll do it with Mick because Mick's better at it than I am, you know. And so me and Mick did Ellen, or Ethel, as I used to call her.
There's a song of yours off All American Alien Boy called You Nearly Did Me In that's got Roger Taylor, Brian May and Freddie Mercury. How did they get involved with singing backing on that?
My wife Trudy was on a plane coming back from England. I was in an Electric Lady doing All American Alien Boy, and they were on the same plane as my wife, and they said, "What was I up to?" You know, because they know Trudy. And she said, "He's down Electric Lady making a record." So they got off the plane, came straight down. Three of them. John didn't come. The other three came. I didn't even know they were there. I came out of the studio, and there they were, sitting in the room there, you know, like, can we do anything? And it was fun. It was great.
Your album Rant from over 20 years ago seemed to set you off on another run of great albums. And there's a song on there called Rip Off. Was that about kind of your feelings of Britain at the time?
I guess so. It's 20 odd years ago, so I can't really remember where my head was at that time, you know, but yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah. It was when I met Andy York. It was kind of like, you know, Mick had gone, and I'd sort of stopped for 5 or 6 years, and meeting Andy York, it was a big one. It was like meeting another Mick. Rant's good, one of the best for me.
Crazy, but it's true.
What about the song When the World Was Round? Because that's got some great imagery in the lyrics. Do you recall writing that song?
I just remember too much information, not enough to go on. That's all I remembered. I like that line, you know. Sometimes you're writing and you're piddling around and a line will make all that difference. You know, it's between kind of like that could be a song or no, this is a song. And that's all I remember about that particular track. But a lot of stuff over the years, you know what I mean? My memory's not that great.
That song in particular, there seems to be a thread with some of the themes on your new album in a way that slightly disillusionment with what's going on. But in the end, there is some hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I just see it as it is.
Too much information, not enough to go.
There's a song of yours released about 7-8 years ago, which was Dandy. I've read that was about David Bowie. Is that right?
Yeah, good song. I was working on, I think it was called Lady or something else. And then that happened with To David, and Dandy just fit. I was already working on the song and it had a different lyric. I just transferred it when I heard about Dave, because we owed him.
To close, what are your plans? Would you think there will be a Defiance Part 3, or are you working on a different project?
Oh, you never know. You never know. I mean, I'm working, and yes, I've got tracks, but not too many. I stopped for 6 years once. I stopped for 5 years once. The minute I say I'm on a roll, I'm not. It's something you don't want to talk about.
Ian, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you all the best with Defiance Part 2. It's a great album, and I've loved listening to it, and it's been great to talk to you, so thank you.
All right, you're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Star, there soul from the past to the future. We explore with each episode. The journey unfolds in the strange brew stories untold. Ooh, the show.